Beth Ann Finley wanted to be an actress in high school, but then as a Notre Dame student in the early 90s, she discovered contemporary poetry that changed her life. Now, the Poet Laureate of Mississippi until 2020, she's living up to her lifelong mission of spreading the joy of poetry.
One thing that's frustrating for me about poetry is that people are intimidated by it. I think poetry can improve people's lives.
Improve your life by listening to Beth Ann Finley's poetry today on New Letters on the Air, part of our series on State Poets Laureate, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Born in New Jersey and raised in the Midwest, Beth Ann Finley first transplanted herself to the South when she got her MFA at the University of Arkansas and met her husband. Now she's firmly rooted in Oxford, Mississippi, where she's been living since 2001 with novelist Tom Franklin and their three children. In 2010, she was named Outstanding Teacher of the Year at the University of Mississippi and served as director of their MFA program until she was appointed by the governor as the Poet Laureate of Mississippi in 2016. She followed on the heels of Natasha Trethewey, who's also been featured on New Letters on the Air. The Poet Laureate position varies from state to state. Mississippi started in 1963 with lifetime appointments until it was changed to a four-year term in 2012. So far, all five of their Poets Laureate have been women. Beth Ann Finley's passion for poetry was evident when I talked to her in 2010 while she was a guest of Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. Her books then included the nonfiction collection Great with Child, Letters to a Young Mother, and three poetry books, the 2008 Unmentionables, the earlier Tender Hooks, and her first book, Open House, that won the 2001 Kenyon Review Prize and includes her husband's favorite love poem.
I wrote it thinking about how different our paths were because I'm from a suburb of Chicago and grew up in a family that stressed education and travel and good food and museums. And Tommy grew up in a very rural, wooded Alabama county where he was the first person in his family to graduate high school. And they thought he was so weird for always reading and writing. They loved him, but they didn't understand him. They teased him. And it took us a while to meet. We met in graduate school, and he's 9 years older than I am. But I think we had to have these kind of circuitous paths to meet each other because he had to work so hard even to graduate college because he had to work factories during the day. And when I think of all he had to do to get ready to meet me and for me to get ready to meet him, it just fills me with a sense of blessing.
Would you like to read that one?
Sure. I would like to go back as I am now. To you, as you were then. Then when you bagged grit at the sandblasting factory, loading train cars that took as much as they could stand and got the hell out of Lower Alabama, as you dreamed of doing. Watching them rumble north with your haiku on their dusty sides, written with your spit-wet finger, before changing from your coveralls for your night school literature class, your shame, your hope. Or back, further, to when your mechanic father gave you a fixed-up car, what you had asked for all through high school, except it was the first Japanese car the county had seen, a Toyota. And when you drove by, the boys called it the rice burner. And the girls, pretty, pious, dumb as Dalmatians, wouldn't get inside of it. So you paid $5 in your empty car to watch Planet of the Apes at the drive-in, alone. Or back even further to you in your plaid pajamas, sitting up half the humid night, because asthma sat on your chest and crushed, no matter how you cried uncle. So you drew comic books bulging with muscled heroes until the blue rumble of logging trucks signaled dawn and better breathing, and you could sleep, your chest heaving with its tiny boy nipples, your legs sticking out with their leg bones. I have loved you for your shame and for your busted body, which aches for 3 days after we help friends move, because for years you were valued like a donkey for how much you could carry on your back. I have loved you for your freakishness, your exile in that homeland, where you hid your paperbacks, spoke the local language, rose early and carried a gun if you wanted to walk in the woods. I would go back as I am now, bend over your ribs, lift the damp V of your pajamas and blow on your neck, blow a breeze smelling like snow, sounding like somebody whistling far away. I would go back for a ride in your Toyota, beat time to your 8-track of sticks with my feet on the dash. We'd cruise the drive-in and park, back row center, let the girls gawk at the windows gauzy with heat. I would go back and find you at the simmering factory and free your wet curls from the clench of your hard hat and unlace your boots, almost lunar with red mud, and unzip your coveralls, a zipper as long as all of Lower Alabama. Go back as I am now and reach in and kneel down and lick you to life, the life we couldn't have known we were heading for. A timely, lucky life, starting just beyond the margins of this poem.
Beth Ann Finnelly, that's the poem. I would like to go back as I am now to you as you were then. From her first book, Open House, and this is New Letters on the Air. I can see why that's your husband's favorite poem. It's just really beautiful.
Thanks.
You know, one of the things that is always so hard, especially for writers who are starting out, is to write about people they know and to be as honest and truthful as they can be, even if you're fictionalizing it somewhat. Mm-hmm. But you teach.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get writers to open up, to tell the stories they need to tell?
Sometimes a student has to be ready to tell a particular story, and sometimes being ready involves gaining distance and perspective. For example, something bad happened to them when they grew up, or they're angry at someone and they're writing from a place of anger and they're not able to give their characters depth, and they just have to wait until it's time. And other people are never interested in writing their own life stories, and that's great. I don't think it's important necessarily for people to talk about themselves and their own emotions. I like to do all different kinds of poetry. I'm very greedy. And sometimes I like to write about history. I have a poem in the new book about the French Impressionist Bertha Morisot, and another about the modernist poet John Berryman, and another about Kudzu, A Vine in the South. All of those poems required research and are much more about other people than about me. But it's also true that I like poems that investigate the human soul, and we think our emotions are always perfectly transparent and accessible. But I believe that's very rarely the case. I think it's hard work to understand what you're feeling, and I think reading and writing poetry are ways to educate your emotions. So sometimes I've written poetry just to better understand an experience I've had or thoughts that I'd like to think about again.
Well, that's an interesting approach.
You know, one thing I've learned as I've kept writing is that if I'm interested in something, don't discard it. For example, to write about the kudzu vine in the South is a cliche, but I was drawn to write about it, and I stopped doing something I did when I was younger, which is say, oh, don't write about that, it's already been done, or don't write about that, that would be embarrassing, or there's nothing there, it's stupid, it's boring. If I'm interested in something, if I am patient and work hard, I can figure out what's interesting about it for other people. And the reason I became so fascinated with the kudzu vine started with its beauty, but while I began to research it, I learned a lot of fascinating things about it. For example, it originally comes from Japan. It was brought to the United States for the World Expo in the late 1800s, and they took it and brought it to the South because they believed it'd curb erosion.
And it was supposed to be a great, fast-growing land cover.
Yes, everybody wanted it. The government actually paid people to plant it. Farmers grew it. They had kudzu clubs.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know
that. Yeah, and now it's a terrible scourge. It's over 8 million acres of the South because when they brought the kudzu over, of course, they didn't bring the beetles that eat it. So it's invasive now and killing off a lot of the southern landscape. And I'm originally from the Midwest. I went to the South for the first time at the University of Arkansas for graduate school. I met my husband, and we've settled in Oxford, Mississippi. And I thought, what does it mean to fit in better in a new place than your old home? Thinking about kudzu, that was the door that helped me think about ideas of identity and what is home and how does landscape influence psychology and a lot of kind of bigger topics that if I tried to tackle first with the idea of the big topic, you know, today I'd like to write a poem about identity. It never would have worked, but to be fascinated with the vine can lead you to the bigger questions.
Well, you know, I think we have to have you read that kudzu poem. Do
sure.
you think there's a section you can
yeah,
read?
Yeah, I will read section 1, 4, and 13. How does that sound?
That sounds great.
Okay. Excerpts from the Kudzu Chronicles.
By Beth Ann Finnelly, from the book called Unmentionables, here on New Letters on the Air.
1. Kudzu sallies into the gully like a man pulling up a chair where a woman was happily dining alone. Kudzu sees a field of cotton, wants to be its better half, pities the red clay, leaps across the color wheel to tourniquet, sees every glass half full, pours itself in, then over the brim, scribbles in every margin with its green highlighter, is begging to be measured, is pleased to make acquaintance with your garden, which it is pleased to name place where I am not yet. Breeds its own welcome mat. Section 4. I asked a neighbor early on if there was a way to get rid of it. Well, he said over the kudzu fence, before chuckling and turning back into his house, I suppose if you sprayed it with whiskey, maybe the Baptist would eat it.
It's interesting because just as you read that, you transposed it so that you would end with the Baptist would eat it. Have you rewritten the poem?
I have. I do that very often and sometimes based on reading things aloud. And what I realized is if I have the joke in the middle of the poem and then I have two lines, people laugh and I lose those lines. It's better to end with a joke. I always revise my poems. In fact, I recite them so often in the revised form that reading them to you right now seems strange to me because I'm not used to some of the words being in this order.
So when do you as a poet decide that something's finished?
It's never finished.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, all my books, my reading copies are filled with marks, deletions, and suggestions. It's a sickness.
You so deftly handle humor in your poetry.
Well, humor is something I've grown more comfortable in as my work has progressed. And I think when I first started writing, I was determined to be taken seriously. It took me a long time to realize that the best poetry does justice to the full realm of the human emotions. And serious poetry is an important part of it. But poems could also make us laugh or think or get angry, and maybe I like in a poem what I like in a friend, someone who can share all of me. And I decided not to be so uptight in my own work because I think the world is funny. I think being a mom is funny. I think being alive is funny. I think being married is funny. So I've stopped trying to stamp that out of my poetry. I don't intentionally try to write funny poetry, but when the situation itself has humor in it, I let it be there.
Well, back to the Kudzu Chronicles.
Okay. Section 13. When I die here, for I sense this, I'll die in Mississippi, state with the sing-songiest name I remember at 5, learning to spell. When I die here, my singular stone will stand alone among the Faulkners and the Isoms and the Nelsons, these headstones which fin down hills like schools of fish. Albeit a letter of a foreign font, what the typesetter used to call a bastard. And even when my husband and daughter are dragged down beside me, their shared last name won't seem to claim my own, not to any horseman passing by. Listen, kin and stranger, when I go to the field and lie down, let my stone be a native stone. Let the deer come at dusk from the woods behind the church, and let them nibble acorns off my grave. Then let the kudzu blanket me, for I always loved the heat. Let its hands rub out my name, for I always loved affection.
That's the very last section in the Kudzu Chronicles by Beth Ann Finnelly, from the collection called Unmentionables, here on New Letters on the Air. It must be something living in Oxford, Mississippi, and being in the shadow of Faulkner all the time.
Yes, he does have a big shadow. I think everyone is affected, even if they don't particularly read or have never read Faulkner, because Yacht tourism is such a big thing, and there's Faulkner conferences and Faulkner scholars. Suddenly there's a busload of tourists snapping pictures. There's definitely a community that fosters and supports the interest. But I'm a poet and a carpetbagger, so I don't feel that the huge shadow that others do. Philip Roth actually compared my husband Tom Franklin's first book to Faulkner's first novel, Soldier's Pay. For better or for worse, those are pretty big footsteps to make someone stand in.
It must be kind of nice that one of you is fiction and one of you is poetry. Are you first readers for each other, or do you look outside of your house for people to comment?
No, we're absolutely each other's first readers, and I feel so lucky that we share that. It's so fun for us to help each other. I know some married writers, and they don't work with each other because it's stressful and they feel that the other one's criticizing them. For us, it's just joyful, and it would be very difficult to separate our family life from our writing lives.
Yeah. There are two books that are sandwiched in between Open House and Unmentionables. Tenderhooks explores a lot of your experience with being a mother, and then you've got Great with Child, Letters to a Young Mother. Did these two books kind of go hand in hand for you?
Yeah, Tenderhooks, what happened was my husband and I got pregnant with our first daughter. I didn't plan on writing any poems about her, but I was fascinated by the changes I was undergoing as a new mother, and I wanted to understand them better. And for me, poetry is the best method of investigating the human soul. So I started writing poems to understand what I was going through, and I ended up writing a whole book about my daughter's first year.
Well, Tenderhooks is a misnomer, and all my life I've thought that's what the phrase was.
Yeah, the phrase is actually tenter, T-E-N-T-E-R, and those were the little hooks on the side of the loom that you twist to tighten the warp and the weft of the threads. So to be on tenterhooks was to be tightened up and in a state of anticipation. But I had always misheard it as tenderhooks.
So what is your favorite poem out of Tenderhooks?
Well, although these poems are all united by topic, there's a range of tones, because what I found out about becoming a mother is it expands your emotional capacity in every direction. I have a kind of rage that I never had before.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my kids can drive me crazy. I can scream at them. I don't think I ever yelled at anyone before I became a mom. I'm capable of a terror now that I never believed possible. The extremes of life enter your realm in a new way. And I'm capable of a new kind of joy and a new kind of hilarity and a new kind of tenderness. And I was interested in this expansion of my spirit. And I wanted to think about all the different ways those emotions had entered my life. So the fact that I could have died during childbirth was the first kind of crazy expansion of this role of mother that I was walking into. There's a poem about breastfeeding, and then there's some lighter, funnier poems that try to capture the hilarity of being a mother or the irony. There's several small poems in the book that I wrote, partially I was rereading haiku because that's all I had time to read. And then I started writing small poems because that's all I had time to write. And so there's several two-line poems spaced throughout the book, and one is this. First day at daycare. My daughter comes home smelling like another woman's perfume. So the jealousy of my daughter being with someone else that wasn't me, you know, that's something I never expected, to feel jealousy of my baby in someone else's arms. And one of the things that happened after I published Tender Hooks is people kept saying to me, oh, what's your daughter going to think of your poetry when she's 16? Which was awful because I realized she's going to hate me. Really. And maybe all 16-year-old girls hate their mothers anyway, but I'm not doing myself any favors by writing a whole book about her first year. So I had a terrible sense of foreboding about that day, and I wrote this. Because people ask what my daughter will think of my poems when she's 16. Daughter, the light of the future is apricot, and in it you are not the thigh child, pointing her earnest index finger to the yellow balloon, clearing the willows and drifting higher. You're the balloon. I'm the grasping hand. Or I'm the ooh in balloon. I'll meet you there. I'm the brown strings, formerly violets. You didn't water. I'm the hole in the photos. You're the unsafety scissors. I'm the lint in the corners of my purse after you steal the coins. Brown bag lunch you pitch after leaving my house. Buttons you undo after I've okayed your blouse. Poems you burn in the sink. Poems that had to go and use your name. Never mind that soon you'll be 16. Hate your name. I'm the resemblance you deny. Fat ass you hope your boyfriends never see. I'll meet you there. That is my promise and my threat, with this yellow balloon as my witness. Even if I'm dead, I'll meet you there.
Because people ask what my daughter will think of my poems when she's 16. Beth Ann Finnelly, well, tell me about this book, Great with Child, Letters to a Young Mother.
Tender Hooks came out first, and after I finished that book, I wanted to do something else. I didn't want to write any more about being a mom. I was waiting for some change, some new topic, and I just entered one of those painful fallow periods where nothing is coming. I wanted to write something new. I was waiting for it to appear.
What do you do in times like that? I mean, do you force yourself to
write,
even though you don't?
I cook a lot, Angela, a lot. I bake. I make stews. I give casseroles to the church for invalids. I do a lot of cooking in those times because I need to do something that can point to and see I made it. Something constructive, as opposed to hours sitting at a desk where you have nothing to point to. It's so painful for someone like me who wants to be productive all the time to be a writer when so much of it is not productive at all.
Cooking could be a nice substitute for making a poem because you can be creative with cooking too. You don't have to follow a recipe exactly. And yeah.
And you can use it to show people you love them. You know, to feed people is such a great joy. And when I'm not writing, I do it a lot.
So anyway, you were in this fallow period,
yes,
waiting.
I had for several years been carrying on an email correspondence with a former student of mine. She was in a class I was teaching at a liberal arts college in Illinois called Knox College. She's in a poetry workshop. She ended up having to drop out of my class because her mom was sick with cancer. She wanted to go back to Georgia and nurse her mom. And she said, I just hate that I'll have to stop working with you. And I said, well, Kathleen, just keep sending me poems. You know, you can just send it on email and I'll write you some comments. And so that relationship ended up continuing for several years. And then during this fallow period, she got engaged to get married and her husband had just gotten a postdoc up in Alaska. She said, can I visit you in Mississippi on our drive up there? I said, absolutely, come on. So she came over I remember we were in my kitchen and she was drinking a cup of coffee. She poured it in the sink. She said, you know, coffee just doesn't taste good to me anymore. I used to love coffee. And I looked at her and I said, you're pregnant. She started bawling because, you know, her mom had just passed from cancer. She was moving to a strange city where she had no friends and no job, and she just felt overwhelmed. And I thought motherhood was really hard for me, and I had tons of friends and a great mom. So I told her I would write her a letter every day. And my friend Kathleen was living without a computer, so she was writing me letters longhand, and I was writing her letters longhand. And it was such an interesting rhythm to take up a pen and paper and write longhand a letter to a friend for a couple hours a day sometimes. And it's so interesting to see that different rhythm, that slower, more contemplative way of thinking about life that comes from that slow act of looping the pen across the page. Yeah. And selecting the paper and selecting the envelope and understanding that this missive will be received in time. It's a much different process than email. And time went on, and my friend gave birth and came back to Georgia. And, you know, she said, oh, can I loan your letters to someone? And I said, well, I can't imagine this stranger would want to read stuff about my life that I wrote to you, but okay. And meanwhile, my editor, Norton, said, oh, Beth Ann, I thought we'd have another book of poems from you by now. I said, well, I'm not writing poems. And she said, you're not writing poems? What are you doing? So I told her about the letters, and she asked me if I could get a copy of them and send them to her, and I did, and she said, we want to publish these as a book.
And so it became Greatwood Child, Letters to a Young Mother. What kind of response have you gotten from people?
I think poetry can help us think better and more deeply about our lives and the world in a way that can lead us to make happier choices. But most people think poetry has nothing for them but misery and pain, so they don't read it. So for me, accidentally writing a book of nonfiction was a lovely way to enter the lives of people who wouldn't pick up a book of poetry.
Mississippi Poet Laureate Beth Ann Finley, talking about her 2006 collection, Great with Child, Letters to a Young Mother. In 2017, Norton also published Heating and Cooling, 52 Micro-Memoirs. Since this 2010 conversation as a guest at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series, she's also co-authored a novel with her husband, Tom Franklin, set in Prohibition, Mississippi, called The Tilted World. Now that state's poet laureate from 2016 to 2020, she's the first in our series on state holders of the post. One of the beauties of our decades-old archives is that we can preserve creative voices and stories, but we can't do it alone. Here's New Letters editor Robert Stewart.
If you find this program about writers valuable and enjoyable, you might like to know that New Letters requests your support in our first capital campaign to endow this radio series and its affiliate, New Letters Magazine. New Letters on the Air for 42 years is the program of Gwendolyn Brooks, Joseph Brodsky, Lee Young Lee, Alice Walker, Grace Paley, and Calvin Trillin. New Letters Magazine for 85 years is the magazine of Etheridge Knight, Richard Wright, John Updike, Annie Dillard, Achebe, Cannell, Kuman, and Ginsberg. Go to newletters.org. Send your tax-deductible gift, and let's secure this legacy of publications and broadcasts for future generations.
The Support New Letters button in the top right corner of newletters.org also includes Bookmark Press, publisher of the 2018 American Book Award winner, Currents, by Bojan Lewis. He's also in our audio archives. Our current magazine features literary award winners, including one judged by Alberto Rios, the debut Arizona Poet Laureate, who can be heard next week. To keep up, follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and Instagram. A production of UMKC's New Letters Magazine. Today's show was originally produced with Annie Walsh, Max Mosley, and Dennis Conroe, with updates by Anna Stokes and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.